From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the latest on the sentencing of Michelle Carter, where both the prosecution and the defense just finished making their cases.
The defendant undertook a deliberate, well-thought-out campaign to cause the death of Conrad Henry Roy.
Praise Your Honor's judgment of leniency in this sad circumstance where she herself had mental health issues going on.
Why your internet browsing history might not be as private as you thought.
Well, what this guy found out in Germany was that there are a variety of tactics you can use to simply figure out who the person is.
Also today, writer Ann Patchett talks about her book, Commonwealth, about two families broken apart and rejoined together.
I think that being thrown together, being pulled out of a family and put into a family has always been very interesting to me.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We're going to take a look at two local trials going on today. We'll get to the sentencing of Michelle Carter in a moment. Michelle Carter has been sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. All the details coming up in a few minutes. We want to look first at a trial that's asking where we draw the line between protected union activity and illegal strong-arming. Testimony continued today in the case of four Teamsters accused of threatening to disrupt the filming of reality TV show Top Chef, and that was back in 2014, unless the production crew agreed to hire union labor. The Teamsters say they were simply exercising their right to picket. If convicted, the four men could each face up to 20 years in prison. Today, David O'Connell, the NBC Universal executive who oversees production of Top Chef, testified that he offered the Teamsters double to leave the set in the town of Milton. A former freelancer testified after a confrontation with the Teamsters, he found his tires slashed. The Boston Globe's Maria Kramer was in the courtroom today. She's been covering the trial and joins us now. Hello, Maria. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
So the opening statements were Tuesday morning. U.S. District Judge Douglas Woodlock was at the helm of all this. What's the prosecutor's angle here?
The prosecutor is trying to make the argument that these were not needed jobs, that the reason this is extortion is that the union was, the Teamsters specifically, were using strong-arm tactics, were threatening to shut down production, were threatening to picket in order to wrangle jobs that essentially were not needed to be filled, because at this point, Top Chef had its staff. They had production assistants doing the job that the Teamsters wanted to do.
I mentioned a couple of things about what witnesses said today, and I wonder if you could say a little bit more what happened in the courtroom.
Sure, yes. I mean, you had a slew of witnesses who all got up on the stand and essentially testified to very similar activity by the union, which is by the Teamsters, which is that there was chest bumping of staff, of Top Chef staff at the restaurant Steel and Ryan Milton. There were slurs hurled at women. One of the producers was called a towel head. Her name is Ellie Cupra Hall, and she was called Brown Ellie. Expletives that used for women were hurled at the female producers, and tires were slashed. You had two witnesses talk about finding their tires slashed after they confronted Teamsters.
So we have a bit of tape from Ellie Kalbrahal. She testified about, as you mentioned, her encounter with the Teamsters after they descended on the shoot in Milton, and they threatened the crew, and their threats were caught on a cell phone camera. This is not the testimony, I'm sorry. So here's a bit of that cell phone audio, and it starts with Ellie Kalbrahal.
Your mama would be so proud.
Yeah. At least she knows I'm not a scab like you.
What'd you say?
You heard me.
You're right.
Good.
Wow.
Maria, this reaction, this tape rather, was played in the courtroom. What was the reaction to the video?
Very emotional as she was describing the behavior of the Teamsters that day. She started to cry. She had to wipe away tears, and as she struggled to talk about what happened to her and the insults that were hurled at her. And in the courtroom, the reaction has been muted to the video, and the defense has been very quick to point out that this is the only video that exists of the confrontation at Milton that day. That there's no other video of the alleged chest bumping or slashing of tires, or, as has been widely reported, the threats that Padma Lachki, one of the hosts of Top Chef, claims were made against her.
You know, it's interesting, given that it is a TV set, or is a set where there's a lot of filming going on, that Moore hasn't been caught on film. Or maybe it's not allowed to be used for some reason.
There was no other video, actually. That's basically what the Top Chef crew has admitted, that's the only video that exists. It's the only video that they took. The other point that the defense has made is that Milton police, who were hired as detail because they were anticipating picketers, they were hired as detail by Top Chef. The Milton police did not intervene. They did not do anything in terms of arresting the men. And the argument from the defense has been that it's because there was nothing for them to do. The Teamsters were not violating any laws, and the police did not see them violate any laws.
And will Milton police be called to testify?
It appears, yes, that there will be the two police officers who were at the scene that day are scheduled to testify. The defense has talked about them taking the stand.
Okay. So for some who were experiencing what is intimidation, alleged intimidation, it was not just intimidation. Those on the set said that they were fearful for their life. Derek Cunningham is among them. What else did you hear in terms of a real concern that this was not just about, you know, go home or hire us, but that people were threatened?
And that's where things are a little tricky for the prosecution, or maybe for the jury, to try and figure out if anybody's life was really threatened, because Derek Cunningham did say under cross-examination that no threats were made to his life, that nobody ever physically menaced him, that it was the aggressive tactics of the Teamsters with whom he spoke that made him feel unsettled, intimidated, and nervous enough that he felt like he had to sleep with a knife. But no, there were no actual physical threats. And the other witnesses who've testified have also said that nobody physically menaced them. Nobody, aside from the chest bumping, which, as we know, was not caught on tape, nobody was attacked. And whether or not that's an issue for the jury as they try to figure out if this is extortion remains to be seen. But that is one thing that we've seen here in this trial, is that there were a lot of threats, allegedly, and there were a lot of insults. We've heard them. We've heard the tapes, but there was no physical menace.
Maria Kramer from the Boston Globe. You know, we talked about four Teamsters on trial here. A fifth Teamster was charged and reached a plea agreement with prosecutors. That was last year. Mark Harrington pleaded guilty to attempted extortion. Is there any bearing for the others on trial here, for the other Teamsters, from that?
At this point, it's not clear. I don't believe Mark Harrington is going to be testifying against his former brothers in the union. And it's when he pled guilty, he was also very careful about, you know, about what he said, about what he did, and the illegality of it. And some analysts have seen that as perhaps an attempt to protect the four men who are now on trial.
All right, let's get the politics of this just out there a little bit. If you can explain that there is a Boston City Hall official, Kenneth Brissett. He's involved in this in some way. He is the city official who had been indicted for attempting to withhold permits from a music festival called Boston Calling unless organizers hired union workers. Can you talk about what's going on there, and whether this is uncomfortable for Mayor Marty Walsh, who is running for re-election?
Yes, this is quite uncomfortable for Mayor Walsh. His name has not been mentioned at all during the trial, and as we know, he's not been charged with anything, but he has seen two highly placed officials indicted, and one of them is Ken Brissett, as you mentioned, and his name has been mentioned a lot by witnesses, including Derek Cunningham, including NBC executives, including producers, who said that he wanted the show to reach a deal with the Teamsters and use words to the effect of, just, this will all go away if you make a deal with the Teamsters. Derek Cunningham also testified that it was Ken Brissett who talked about canceling permits that had already been issued to Top Chef to film in other parts of the city, and that this conversation took place after Ken Brissett learned from Derek Cunningham that the Teamsters were very angry about the presence of Top Chef in the city.
Okay, Maria Kramer, thank you so much for joining us. We can check in with you again, I hope, for this the story on this trial.
Anytime.
Maria Kramer is a reporter on the criminal justice system for the Boston Globe. So unions have been a part of Massachusetts history, a part of Boston's history, part of the nation's history, maybe not in this city as much as in San Francisco or Chicago, but the city has been built up with workers from carpenters and plumbing unions, and the Teamsters have had a role unifying those building trades. They've done many, many good things in the city. Boston city leaders going back and now, as we just talked about, have ties to unions. Mayor Marty Walsh is the former president of Laborers Local 223. Joining us now is Thomas Kokin, a professor at MIT and co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jill.
Thanks for joining us. Is Boston generally considered a union-friendly city? And how intertwined is the city with unions?
Well, Boston is one of the top 10 unionized cities in the country. It clearly doesn't quite rank up there with New York and San Francisco, but it has a long tradition of unionization in both the private sector, building trades, services. The Teamsters are over 100 years old here, and then more recently in the public sector in the last 30 years or so. So it's a strong union town. And it's one that is got a reputation, I think, as being relatively traditional in the sense that each of the unions sort of does its own thing, and there isn't an overall strong vision for where the labor movement overall needs to go. And so you get incidents like this.
Right. Professor Kokin, can you talk a little bit more? You know, not all of us pay attention to union labor as it has created a place, you know, a city like Boston. When we talk about who is in the city and who is working and who's in part of a union, what are we talking about? I mean, we're talking about plumbers and carpenters, but what else? There's a lot going on that's union related.
Yeah, there are sort of three pockets of union strength in the area. Certainly the public sector is the largest, police, fire, teachers and public works employees and so on, and state government employees. That's the largest. Then I think it would be the building trades, because Boston has been a boom town for building and growth over the last 20 years or so. Those unions have had their ups and downs as the economy changes, but they're quite strong. And now, more recently, the service sector, service employees in healthcare, in education, and the hotel workers, in particular the hospitality sector, has really grown significantly and in a very creative and positive way for very low-wage workers in the region.
So companies come to Boston, right, to establish their business. You know, I mean, everybody from General Electric on out, you know, and also, of course, hotel industry. What is the general take on the city of Boston and its unions from industry and from companies, from corporations?
My sense in talking with companies is that they understand that they're coming into a highly unionized area relative to the rest of the country, that unions are linked well in the community to both employers and to politicians, and that they need to figure out ways to work with unions rather than get into big confrontations with them, because that's the way the community does business.
I realize that, Thomas Kokin, that you don't want to comment on the case that we just spoke about with Maria Kramer, but can you talk about the Teamsters with and its past, and its checkered past, that there have been other incidents of strong-arm tactics alleged in the Top Chef case. There have been other times when this union in particular, the Teamsters, has been involved in crime, whether that's financial crime or otherwise.
There's a long history of the Teamsters. They have had a checkered history nationally and to some extent here in Boston as well. Their most recent leader has been indicted and convicted of embezzling funds. It goes back to other groups as well. At the same time, the Teamsters have been a constructive force in a number of cases. There was a big process of having to integrate the Turnpike Authority Teamster employees into the Department of Transportation several years ago, and I mediated that dispute. The Teamsters were very responsive. They were very tough to deal with, but you knew when you had a deal with them and you knew when you didn't have a deal, and I think they have that reputation. They also recently negotiated an appropriate severance and adjustment and placement of the people who were displaced as we went to automated systems on the turnpike.
Right, the toll takers.
The toll booth workers. And so that's a very constructive process of adjusting to changes in technology.
So mediation, we've had both going on here. I'm sorry. Mediation, meaning to keep up with the times as the industry and the world changes, as you mentioned, technology, is one thing, but going to trial is another. So how common is it to see union members on trial again for this question of whether this is a freedom to picket or intimidation?
Well, this is a sad story and a sad case. Thank God it's the exception. You don't see much of this. You know, the movie industry, the TV industry is an itinerant industry. You have projects and shows that come and go and concerts that come and go and so on. And you have all kinds of unions around the country that work with the industry to staff those periodic programs. And usually they work out these issues. When they don't, then you have these kinds of marginal examples of, is it just picketing? Is it just putting pressure on? Or is it they're taking my job away and therefore I'm going to get very aggressive and sometimes go over the line?
Right. Well, Thomas
Too
Kochan,
bad it happened here.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to watch as this city develops. Thank you so much for perspective on this. It's good not to just put this in a vacuum, but to really look at the long view. I appreciate your time.
Well, it's good to talk with you.
Thomas Kochan is a professor at MIT and co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll hear the latest from the courtroom in Taunton, where Michelle Carter was just sentenced a few minutes ago to 2.5 years in jail. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Not to reveal too much about myself, but I've been looking up online just in the past week, mostly on Google, vitamin D deficiencies, my kid's summer camp, because I can't remember the zip code. I can't keep it in my head, and I owe her a letter, and a drink recipe that would include rum, ginger syrup, and whatever else I have in the fridge. And I looked up some other things I don't think I want to tell you about. Maybe you did too. Something maybe more intimate. And thinking these searches are private, I think I'm covered and you are too. But if they became public, it could be embarrassing or worse. Maybe if info got into the wrong hands, could end a career. Boston Globe tech reporter Hiawatha Bray writes today about privacy, as he has done in the past. He joins us now to talk about why our searches, which we think are private, might actually be traceable. Hi, Hiawatha.
Hi.
Can you explain this? Is this new that my searches could, and that's an emphasis on could, end up being public? How is that possible?
Well, I don't know how much of it is new. It's just that some folks in Germany who really did this research late last year and talked about it just last week in Las Vegas at the DEF CON Hackers Conference, these guys in Germany did some research and found out that by using a bunch of stuff, much of which has probably been out there all along, you can, in effect, de-anonymize people's internet behavior and find out exactly who is behind certain kinds of activities, and thereby know pretty much everything you want to know about their lives. What it involves is the fact that there are companies out there known as data brokers. I'm sure you've heard of them. But these guys buy information about people from all kinds of public sources. And it turns out that one of those sources are those little plugins that a lot of us like to use in our browsers.
What was a plugin?
Plugins and extensions. They're slightly different. But there are pieces of software that you can install in popular browsers like Chrome that will do certain things. You can put a game into the browser so it appears right in your browser. You can plug in an ebook reader, or you could plug in a weather app or something like that. Mm-hmm. There are hordes of these things floating around, thousands of them, and many of us attach them to our browsers. Some of them actually collect the data that you are clicking on when you are using your browser, and they sell the data to data brokers. They are simply selling what is known as the click stream, all the various things that you've clicked on in the course of your using your computer. Now, the problem is that this stuff is supposed to be, in theory, anonymous. They don't say whose computer it is. They just say, here, here's somebody's clickstream. And these companies would tell you, we're not violating anybody's privacy because we're not sharing the identities of these people. But two German researchers, one of them was a TV reporter and the other one is an actual data scientist, decided to see if that was true, because what they thought they could do would be to take those click streams, analyze them, and pull out information that would reveal who these people are. And they found out that they were able to do it thousands of times.
Right, but it wasn't simple. Like, it wasn't that I could go in there and figure this out. They had to come up with a code to do this?
They ended up writing some software to do it. But the point is that the kinds of people we're worried about who might be spying on us, like corporations or governments, they can do that too. You and I as an individual, we probably couldn't do it. The typical hacker, they couldn't do it. But could a major corporation do it? Of course. Could a government agency do it? You bet. And what they were able to find was amazing. They were telling members of German parliament what drugs they were prescribing, what drugs they were taking for various medical ailments. They were able to figure out, in other words, these people's, at least part of these people's medical histories. They were able to track down a judge who had a taste in pornography. They figured out that the clickstream belonged to a specific person who turned out to be a judge and who also looked at porn.
So note, I'm a layperson, Hiawatha. How is it different than cookies? Or how is it different than how an engine, a search engine, or my carrier might be tracking me now?
Well, we've got to think about this on multiple levels. You just saw this big deal with Trump administration and Congress shooting down some Obama-era regulations about your ISP sharing your data. Now, that one is particularly sensitive because your internet provider knows exactly who you are. They don't have to hunt around to find out. They know who you are. Now, they have insisted that they don't sell this data and they don't give out personal information about their users. But this regulation that would have forbidden that is no longer in effect, and so in theory, they might be able to start doing that. But what happens if you've got clickstream data that really doesn't have somebody's name in it? You really don't know who this person is. Well, what this guy found out in Germany was that there are a variety of tactics you can use to simply figure out who the person is. Give you a perfect example. Twitter. If you use Twitter, and if you're a celebrity or you're a politician, there's a good chance you're going to go to this page called Tweet Activity and see who's looking at your tweets, which ones they're looking at, what are the most popular tweets, which ones are getting the most reaction to. If you go to that page, one of the things that's included in the clickstream is your real Twitter handle. It's right there, right where everybody can see it. If somebody has access to the clickstream, they just look for everybody who went to Tweet Activity and they pull out all their Twitter names. You now know who that person is. You know exactly who it is. They say that they found something like 10,000 people's identities just by doing that one method. And that is relatively easy.
Right, and relatively alarming, I would say.
Yeah.
Is it legal in Germany for this clickstream data to be sold and also to be for you to be identified as the user of said drug or watching such movie?
Well, that's a complicated question because nobody's actually apparently come after these guys. But, and I was talking to one of the reporters who did this, under German law, it doesn't sound like it ought to be legal because it is against the law to share personal information about anybody without their explicit permission.
What about in the U.S.?
Right now in the U.S., there's no law against this at all, except, well, there's FTC regulations about sharing personally identifiable information. So maybe the FTC might intervene. But there's no, as far as I know, explicit law against it. There's certainly no federal law that flatly forbids it. And so, because here's the problem with this. You could make an argument that they are not sharing personally identifiable information. Like I said, they say, hey, there's no names attached to this. We haven't done anything wrong. The problem is that somebody who buys this information can use other methods to then attach a name to it. So it's an open question whether any existing law would have any application because you're not really selling the information with the names attached.
Hiawatha,
so they could say, well, we haven't done anything wrong.
Hiawatha, we have just a moment left. What can anyone do to protect themselves against this from happening? Let's say we're in the U.S. If it's happening, and is there going to be conversation about this, as far as you know, on any kind of legislative level?
Well, that's really weird because one possibility is to just not use browser extensions because it's very difficult to know whether a browser extension is doing this or not. You might try contacting the people who make your favorite browser extensions and say, are you doing this? Ask them and find out if they're willing to tell you. But if somebody wants to build a browser extension that does this and they don't want to tell you, you may not have any way of knowing. So you might be better off not using them at all. In the long run, I think we're going to need a law that just flatly says you can't do this without getting the person's permission. Marsha Blackburn, a Republican from Tennessee who was widely considered an enemy of internet privacy because she was opposed to the Obama regulations, has really turned on a dime, and she's put forward legislation that would do exactly that. It would make it illegal to share any information about anybody unless they gave explicit permission.
Hiawatha Bray, thank you so much for bringing this to light. I hope we haven't set off too many alarms, meaning this isn't happening. This isn't necessarily happening right now, just to clarify.
It might be. No, the problem is we don't know, because all that this guy demonstrated, the German hacker demonstrated, is stuff anybody with enough resources could be doing right now.
Okay.
We don't know for sure whether it's being done, so beats me.
All right, we'll check in on this. Hiawatha Bray is the tech reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to what happened in a Taunton, Massachusetts courtroom earlier this hour when Michelle Carter received a sentence from Judge Lawrence Moniz.
Ms. Carter, a guilty finding having entered on the indictment charging you with the involuntary manslaughter of Conrad Roy III now sentences you to 2.5 years in the Bristol County House of Correction. 15 months of said sentence shall be deemed a committed sentence, and the balance thereof shall be suspended until August 1st of 2022.
That's Judge Lawrence Moniz speaking just a few minutes ago in the Taunton courtroom as he sentenced Michelle Carter for involuntary manslaughter for her role in the suicide of her friend, Conrad Roy III. During the trial, the prosecution presented texts and Facebook messages Carter sent Roy throughout their relationship, encouraging him to follow through on his plans to take his life. This goes back to July 2014, when Conrad Roy used a portable generator to fill his truck with carbon monoxide while in a Kmart parking lot. And having regrets, Roy exited the vehicle and called Carter to tell her he was afraid and uncertain about his plans. Carter then instructed him to get back in the truck and follow through with his plans. Roy obeyed those words and got back into the truck, which had filled by that time with toxic fumes, and he died. Joining us now is WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, who has followed the trial and was in the court for the sentencing. Hi, David. We're going to make sure we can hear you loud and clear. Also with us is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
David, let's start with you. What was going on in the courtroom? Can you describe what was happening after the sentence was handed down?
Sure. What the judge has done here is he has split the verdict. He's coming in with 2.5 year sentence.
David, I'm going to interrupt you. Is there any way that you can make sure that you're on your handset?
Hold on.
And David, stand by for a second. Nancy Gertner, this case, we know, having covered it and having read a lot about it, has set some legal precedents in Massachusetts. Can you talk about what was unique? Let's go back to the conviction. What was unique about this conviction?
Well, it was unique in a number of ways. One, we're a jurisdiction that does not have a statute for assisting suicide. So to some degree, this set of facts had to be shoehorned into involuntary manslaughter, which is a common law 200 and more year old crime. It was unique in the sense that typically assisting in a suicide is someone who provides the instrumentality, someone who's present, who provides the drugs or the gun or whatever, typically not just talk. We also don't have laws in Massachusetts that require people to be good Samaritans, to interrupt a crime, to intervene, except under very narrow circumstances. And ultimately, the judge decided that although Roy was prepared to commit suicide, in the minutes before he did, Michelle Carter ought to have told him to stop. So that was unique. And then their relationship was purely electronic. Apparently, they'd met only once. So this is pure words that assisted a suicide, and that is unique.
Mm. David Boeri, we have you back there. Can you describe what was happening in the courtroom? I mean, as the sentence was handed down, there was family members there on both sides of this very sad story.
At the time of sentencing, Michelle Carter was braced. She was dry-eyed now. Her face looked a little downturned, a little surly. She knew something was coming, and it was going to be bad. As it turned out, the judge said. He criticized her. He said, I don't think her immaturity, I don't think her age was a factor in what happened, but we are a juvenile court. She was 17 at the time of this, and children need to be treated as children. So that was the basis for which he said we need to balance that which might have been appropriate in an adult court and that for this defendant who was 17 at the time. So he imposed a sentence of 2.5 years in the Bristol House of Corrections. She will serve 15. And then when that
15
happened...
15 months.
15 months. 15
right,
15
months.
Thank you. She'll serve 15 months. She'll be under strict probation. He talked tough about all the conditions, but the fact is... Moniz, who's known as somewhat of a compassionate judge, went lightly as far as the prosecution was concerned. They wanted 7 or more. The family was calling for 20. He did say, he said that he wanted her to be committed today. At that point, the defense made a motion that it should be stayed because, as Nancy has talked about, highly controversial finding. This is going to the appeals court. The defense attorney made the point that by the time if she were to go to jail now, she might be through serving before her case could possibly potentially be overturned.
David, so I want to hear from you more on that and also how people reacted. But Nancy Gertner, is there in a criminal case, there is always the potential for an appeal. Would that have been a factor in the judge's sentence today?
Well, it shouldn't have been. It absolutely shouldn't have been. The judge is not supposed to say, hey, I'll give a light sentence because there's a chance that I'm going to be appealed, and the lower the sentence, the less likely the appeal. That's actually not supposed to be a factor involved in this. It was a very thoughtful, I thought an extraordinarily thoughtful rendition of the sentence. He talked about this, the juvenile court being a unique and special court, and talked about the neuroscience of juveniles, which suggests that whoever you are in this period of time, you are going to change, you're going to evolve, and therefore rehabilitation works, particularly here. And then talked about balancing the very serious crime on the one hand against the possibilities of change, both because of her age and because of her situation.
And David, can you describe...
That's why he talked so toughly about some of the conditions that she would meet upon her release from jail, because he seems to know, and his statements indicated, he knows that there was a call for a stiff sentence. So he was very tough in his talk. He was more compassionate in the sentence.
Right.
Do you want to describe, David, if you can? I know that you can. You were sitting there. What happened when the judge read the sentence? How did Michelle Carter react, and how did Conrad Boy's family react?
Well, at the time of the sentencing, she had just got. I saw her as she came into the courtroom. She was crying and trying to control herself, walking into the courtroom at the beginning of this. By the time sentencing came around, she had been thoroughly condemned as vicious by the family, by the prosecution, as vicious, manipulative, and just reviled. And so at the point of sentencing, even at the harsh comments of the judge saying he didn't think that her question of her maturity or her youth played any role in it, that she was knowing and understood what she was doing, so she turned tough. She was dry-eyed and turned somewhat surly, thinking the worst was going to come. It was at that point, in fact, that this judge, who has surprised us before in this trial, imposed the 2.5 with 15 months to be served.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure that we hit some important bigger picture issues as well as what just happened today. There's been a lot of talk about what this decision could mean for issues of speech in other legal cases. Michelle Carter was miles away when Conrad Roy killed himself. She did not, as you've said, supply any of the materials he used. This was a crime committed over text and internet. So is it we say things all the time on text that are nasty or that are sarcastic. So is it common to hear
people... Well, let me set up.
Yeah.
Let me set up how it happened, and then Nancy could. I want to hear. I love to hear what Nancy has to say.
I love when you two just set it up, knock it down. Go ahead.
Let me. So what he said in his verdict a couple of months ago in June was it had nothing to do with the texts. It had to do with the phone calls that followed. That she knew what he was doing was going to impair his life. That she ordered him to get back in the car. And so his finding was that her command to somebody that she had was able to manipulate, that was the cause of death, and that she had a duty, because she knew that she had created this hazard, she had a duty to call for help to stop it, and she didn't do it, and that was the basis for the involuntary manslaughter.
Nancy Gertner, though this is, and you spoke about this months, back in June, that this verdict initially sets a new and radical precedent. So say more about that, if you could, about how we use speech now.
Well, speech is never absolutely protected. So those who say this is a free speech issue, we can threaten people with speech, and that can be actionable as a crime. What's significant here is that this was speech in a particular context, and one can imagine other contexts that would be vulnerable, right? The doctor who advises you how to commit suicide when you're asking about it, when you're particularly vulnerable, when you're really upset, would that, and then you do it, would that context plus the speech be actionable? One can think about a slippery slope, which is troubling, which is why most states that want to deal with this legislatively and with clarity in an assisted suicide statute, and not through manslaughter.
David, last word. Go ahead.
But this is going to be very controversial. It's going to be a heated battle for appeal. The judge was even anticipating it perhaps becoming a federal matter.
Right.
But it needs to be stated that the state's highest court, the SJC, did say, when it had this matter before it, that the prosecution could go forward on the basis of words and words alone.
Right, which is going to make this is an uphill battle as an appeal, because there was a prior decision. Now, the SJC has changed to some degree, and if there's any difference between the facts as alleged and the facts as presented at trial, that could be a basis to challenge the verdict.
But Nancy Gertner, David Boeri.
Yes,
let's get you both in here in the studio to keep watching this. Thank you so much. Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst. Thank you for being with us today, Nancy.
Thanks.
WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. See you out in Western Mass, I hope. Thanks so much for joining us.
See you soon.
We'll be right back. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. So not only are the Obamas heading to Martha's Vineyard for the weekend, so is the award-winning writer Ann Patchett. She and maybe the Obamas will be at the Martha's Vineyard Book Festival. Ann Patchett's most recent book, Commonwealth, is now out in paperback. It is the story of a family, of two families, of a mixed family, of the strange and evolving relationships between step-siblings and divorced spouses and parents and children. And it follows the way two families break apart and how they come together as a whole other kind of entity. Joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Ann Patchett, Commonwealth, her latest book again. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Boston.
I had no idea the Obamas were going to be in Martha's Vineyard this weekend.
Well, I've arranged
I'm just sitting
for you
here
to have lunch with, you know, any of the foursome, if you'd like, or the whole foursome. No, I have no
That's
control
really
over that.
Really kind of you. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, really, I'm glad that we could let you know this. No, it's big news. It's big news for state police. It's big news for the island. It's big news for the for that wonderful little game room in one of the neighborhoods, because that's where the kids used to go. And my kids saw
and,
them
And
there,
it's so. Big news. It's big news for me. Come on.
I hope they come to see you, especially.
Can you imagine?
It's a beautiful book that you've written, and Patchett, I know it's one of several novels, and there are some things that you've repeated that have been linchpins or launch pads for the, how the stories fall out. And in this case, the case of Commonwealth, it's a kiss. It's an illicit kiss. And it happens between a man and a woman who are not married, and their families are all around them. You follow the Keatings and the cousin families over 50 years. Could you start us off with a reading of that kiss.
Sure.
This is not. I'm not. This is not a spoiler alert. This begins.
No.
You know, the begins. The begin. It sets us all in motion. So just to
it's
let
kind
me,
of a
yeah.
book without spoiler alerts. So
oh,
I think
that's
we're gonna
good.
Be safe. Yeah.
So Bert Cousins. Okay. He is. You want to lay this out, or do you want me to give a little?
Sure.
Tease?
Sure. I can do it. This is Fix Conroy has a new baby. He is a police officer in Los Angeles. It's the early 1960s. They're having a big christening party. Somebody from the DA's office has crashed the party because he wants to get away from his family. And they kiss. Everybody's drunk, as people so often are at christening parties on Sunday mornings. And he has a crush on the wife. And here we go. He put his arm around her back, pressed his fingers into the straight line of her zipper. It was the magic of gin and orange juice. The baby balanced between the two of them, and he kissed her. That was the way this day was turning out. He closed his eyes and kissed her until the spark he had felt in his fingers when he touched her hand in the kitchen ran the entire shivering length of his spine. She put her other hand against the small of his back while the tip of her tongue crossed between his parted teeth. There was an almost imperceptible shift between them. He felt it, but she stepped back. He was holding the baby. The baby cried for a second, a single red-faced wail, and then issued a small hiccup and pressed into Cousin's chest.
That's quite an early scene in a beautifully written piece. And this was in the nursery, is that correct?
Great.
Okay.
Great.
In brief, what happens then? Is there an immediate shift in family life? Does this become known?
No, it actually takes a while. And the thing about this book is every moment is not covered. So the next time we see the two of them, they are married and living on the other side of the country with six children because he has four and she has two. So we don't play out every second of the relationship.
I do have to ask something that I couldn't figure out. When we, you know, Bert shows up, another member of the district attorney's office is there. How does he find out? This is another of those things that's not covered. How did he know there was a christening that changed everything?
Oh, actually, it is covered.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It is covered. You were skimming.
There's
a moment where Fix, the cop, the father, is talking to the other district attorney, and he says, you know, we'll see you on Sunday. And then Bert Cousins walks down and says, what's going on Sunday? And the district attorney says, oh, he's having a christening party. And Bert says, first kid? And he says, no, it's his second kid. But, you know, those Catholics, they can't get enough of those parties. So that's how he knows.
Let me just quote this. I'm not even reading. Two girls, what are you going to do?
That's right.
Listen, I'm
exactly.
not. I, that one's
two
stuck,
daughters.
Two
so
daughters,
sorry.
Right. Sorry. It's stuck in my memory. But it is that moment that changes everything for these families. And as you say, you jump into these people's lives down the road. This is a family where children are often left to their own devices in this mixed family. Parents make themselves the priority, which is interesting. And it's a different era. It's not taking place in 2017.
Right.
Can you talk about the relationships? We didn't want to bring up too many names because we didn't want to make people think they had to have a family tree in front of them. But
exactly.
There are step-parents, siblings, former spouses. The primary players here, it's the couple who has all those children on that vacation with them.
Yeah, I mean, I say this is a book with 11 main characters. So there are four parents, right? Because they're two different couples and they each lose a spouse and marry each other. And there are six kids. And then later on in the book, there is one novelist. So there are 11 main characters. It's over 50 years and it takes place in many states. I want to say something, though, about what you just said about, you know, the parents aren't really looking after the children. It was so interesting to me when I was out on book tour. People were very upset. They thought the parents were so neglectful. They were just terrible. But I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. I'm 53. And that's just the way everybody's family was. You'd put the kids outside in the morning, and if they came home at night, you know, it was a good day, and that was it.
It's very true, having grown up and around within 2 years of you, older than I am. It's a very different time. There is another time in the book. Beverly is now married to Bert. Beverly and Bert,
right.
The two who were kissing in the beginning. And she is raising Bert's children and her own children during the summer. And this is Jeanette and Albie, her stepchildren, and Carolyn and Franny, who we really begin to follow later on, her own children. There's a segment that would be really helpful for listeners, I think, to catch up with all of us. If you could read for us, it's on page 75.
Sure, I got it. You know, it's so disastrous when all the kids come in together because they're miserable for their own reasons. They each miss the parent who's not there. So Franny was in the living room pulling the cat's front legs through the armholes of a doll's dress and crying so quietly, her mother was sure that every single thing she had ever done in her life up until that moment was a mistake. There was no place to go, no place to get away from them, not even the linen closet, because Jeanette hadn't come out of the linen closet since surrendering the cat. Beverly took the car keys and went outside. The minute she closed the door behind her, she was underwater, the summer air hot and solid in her lungs. She thought about the back patio of the house in Downey, how she would sit outside in the afternoons, Caroline on her bicycle, Franny happy in her lap, the smell of orange blossoms nearly overwhelming. Fix had to sell the house in order to pay her half of what little equity they had had and make some child support. Why had she made him sell the house? No one could sit outside in Virginia. She got 5 new mosquito bites just walking to the driveway, and each one puffed up to the size of a quarter. Beverly was allergic to mosquito bites. It was easily 105 degrees in the car. She started the engine, turned on the air conditioner, turned off the radio. She lay across the scorching green vinyl of the bench seat so that no one looking out the front window of the house could see her. She thought about the fact that if she were in the garage rather than in the carport, she'd be killing herself now.
Wow. How old is Franny in this at that point?
I'm going to guess she's probably around 8.
You know, we know that your parents are divorced. You spoke about that on NPR and in various other interviews. Your parents were divorced, excuse me. How much of this is at all based on your own family? And this is... These are very real characters. I know these people. I know them in their different generations. You know, we all might know these people. But what of this is you?
A lot of it. My mother said it best when she read the book. She said, none of it happened and all of it's true. And I think that's about right. The things that happened to these people didn't happen to us, but the emotional content was very similar. The action wasn't similar. But my parents did get divorced, and my mother and father had 2 girls, and my mother married someone with 2 boys and 2 girls, and we moved to the other side of the country, and we were a big, sprawling, messy, extended family who loved each other and formed alliances and did our best. So... You know, again, I'm definitely tapping on my own life more than I ever have in other books. But that's not to say that if you read the book, that's what happened to us.
So you are telling the story of a fictitious family and elements of your own family. And I'm thinking about, you know, how, you know, we hear our younger family members talk about instances and experiences, and they don't get it the way I want them to remember it, right? So,
right.
So, you know, when my niece will retell something, I'm thinking, that's not the way it happened.
Yes.
Or when my own daughter now is capturing these moments. So who owns the story? Who gets to tell this? Franny ends up growing up, and she marries a famous writer.
She just has an affair with him.
She's dating him. She has an affair with him. And what did he do with her life story?
Well, she tells him about her life the way we tell people about our lives when we fall in love with them. And he is a famous author who hasn't written a book or had a good idea in a long, long time. And he wants to write a book very loosely based on her family. And she's incredibly flattered. And then it seems disastrous once it comes out. So this was really me kind of playing out different scenarios in my own fear. I talked to the people in my family, hey, what if I wrote a book that's very loosely based on us? And they all said, yeah, fine, do whatever you want. You know, my family's very supportive, and they were terrific about it. But the fact that the family in the book is horrified was me playing out my fears of what if this worked out a different way? And who does own a story? You know, and that's what I said to my family. I said, I've never written about us or anything based on us. My books are all set in
Peru and in science museums and far, far away. But I said, in not writing about your life, I don't have any access to my own life because there's overlap. And at this point in my career, I want to own every bit of my own brain. I don't want to think, oh, I can't go there for fear I might be stepping on some part of your childhood. Your childhood is my childhood. And everybody seemed to understand that. So
and
who owns the story? Maybe right. We just share it.
The only other, I've read your nonfiction. I read your book about Lucy Greeley, and it's never left me. I have to tell you that.
Thanks.
It was a powerful story about friendship, and that's why it never left me, about relationships, which you really, you do a beautiful justice to. But that also became, it became controversy on who owned that story. Her family was not pleased with how you owned the story. That happens.
It does happen, and if we had a couple hours on live radio, I could walk you through that. But
no, I'm not asking for the. Yeah, I mean, just that whole sense of it's your perspective. It was your story. That was your
right.
story with her.
That's
your
right.
friendship.
That's right.
Well,
just got to be brave. That's all.
Okay, one in quick moment. If Michelle Obama runs into you this weekend and she says, "Oh, I hear you own a bookstore. What could you recommend for me? What could I read this summer besides your books, Ann Patchett?"
Read this summer the new Tom Perrotta book that is out just this week.
He was just on the show yesterday. Okay.
Oh, was he? Mrs. Fletcher. It is dirty and harsh, and I loved it. I am sitting here right this minute reading a book by Andrew Sean Greer called Less, which is hysterical, and I want something that makes me laugh, so you've also got to read the David Sedaris Theft by Finding.
Awesome. We have to cut
Very
you
best.
Off, though. And thank you so much.
I know
so
I can do this
much.
All day.
We look forward to hearing how Saturday goes at the Martha's Vineyard Book Festival. Ann Patchett joins us today. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman.